to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCain. As part of our series on solutions, today we'll discuss solutions for prosperity shared by all Americans, not just the wealthy. In 2008, we experienced a major economic crisis that crashed the national and global economy. Taxpayers bailed out Wall Street with hundreds of billions of dollars. Now Wall Street thrives while many on Main Street continue to struggle. Millions of people are left out of the so-called recovery. We see economic growth without shared prosperity. Most of the gains since 2008 have gone to the top 1% of the wealthy. What happened? And what can we do to promote a more broadly shared prosperity that uplifts all Americans? Our guest today is uniquely suited for this discussion, since he was at the table during the economic crisis and helped formulate a response. From 2009 to 2011, Jared Bernstein was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. He then joined the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where he continues as a senior fellow. Bernstein's areas of expertise include federal and state economic and fiscal policies, income inequality and mobility, trends in employment and earnings, international comparisons, and the analysis of financial and housing markets. He is the author and co-author of numerous books, including Getting Back to Full Employment, Crunch, Why Do I Feel So Squeezed?, 9 editions of The State of Working America, and his latest book, The Reconnection Agenda, Reuniting Growth and Prosperity. Bernstein has also published extensively in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, and many other venues. He's a television commentator for CNBC and MSNBC and hosts a wonderful blog at jaredbernsteinblog.com. Jared Bernstein, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks for inviting me on.
I'm so excited about this conversation. You're one of the few economists I know who actually talks in English that we can understand. Good, I would appreciate it. Let's start with one of your areas of expertise, that's on income and wealth inequality. So how bad is it right now? Do the top 10% really own more wealth than the bottom 90% of people? Okay, great. So we know there's concentration both of wealth, which is what people own, and concentration in income, what people are earning on a yearly basis. So we want to address this. We want to kind of spread the wealth around a little bit better. And we're going to get more in depth into things, but just right off the top of your head, what would you say are the top 3 things we need to do to reduce income and wealth inequality?
Now that we know it, let's really show it, darling. Let's give them something to talk about.
Something to talk about.
A little mystery to figure out.
Something to talk about.
Let's give them something to talk about.
Okay, so very briefly, what are the top 3 things we need to do to reduce income inequality? And then we'll get into more depth on it, but just really briefly, what are the top 3 things we need to do?
Well, I would say a full employment labor market is really important. Periods when the job market was tight, we saw less inequality because it gave middle and low-income workers a lot more bargaining power. I would try to really lower the trade deficit. We've lost lots of good blue-collar manufacturing jobs by importing much more from other countries than we sell to them. And then third, this is something that I've just been thinking a lot about lately, is I would think I would really reform our policy around incarceration. That's not only having devastating effects on particularly minority communities, but it's exacerbating inequality and poverty as well.
Okay, good.
And by the way, that's three out of, like, you know, that's three out of a lot of different things, but those are the first three that came to mind.
Right, exactly. No, and I love your most recent book. It's phenomenal. I think it's really groundbreaking, writing about the many steps we can take to have greater shared prosperity. So I'm excited you wrote the book and looking forward to getting
more into that here. Tell people that it's free.
Online.
You can
tell them how.
Yeah, so that you don't have to shell out any of your own hard-earned money to get this book. You can just go to my blog, jaredbernsteinblog.com, and download it for free.
Fantastic, and I will say that it's worth getting that book if only to read the introduction, which gives a great description of you sitting at the table in the crisis as President Obama was coming into office in early 2009. Just a fantastic story that you tell there. So
Thank you. In addition to
having very thoughtful, pragmatic steps that we can take for sharing prosperity. So it's a major piece of work, and I thank you for writing it.
Well, thanks a lot. My pleasure.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. You were the executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, a member of President Obama's economic team in that first term when the world was facing the greatest economic turmoil since the Great Depression. What did you advise the president to do in that crisis?
Well, we were very much in what you'd think of as a Keynesian mode. That is, when you're talking about inequality and the absence of broadly shared prosperity, you're kind of assuming that the economy's growing. It's just that the growth isn't being broadly shared. It's not reaching everyone. Well, we were there in a period when we didn't have that first part in place. Not only was the economy not growing quickly enough, it was shrinking. GDP growth was a big negative. Employment growth was hemorrhaging, you know, hundreds of thousands of jobs per month being lost. So the most urgent intervention was to try to at least temporarily replace the demand that had been wiped out by the Great Recession. And that meant a stimulus package, which in fact the president managed to get through Congress in just a few weeks.
Yeah, I remember that stimulus package, and I know you all had wanted it bigger than it was, but wasn't it something like $980 billion that we got through? And
no, it was more like around $800 billion, but
$800 billion,
but yeah, there were some actually add-ons that would have gotten you up to those bigger numbers later. But yes, we thought that the recession was deep enough to warrant a larger stimulus. But there's always going to be political constraints. So that was one piece. And of course, the Federal Reserve was doing their thing to try to help. There was the credit market rescue or bailouts, the auto sector. So there are lots of moving parts to that.
Right, exactly right. Well, and that stimulus that you provided with that $800 billion really would seem to work effectively in terms of creating jobs, pumping a lot of money out quickly into the economy. And it's impressive to see how far the economy has come since then. I mean, at that point, it's hard to imagine now, really, but at that point, the economy was shedding jobs at the rate of something like 700,000 a month, wasn't it?
Correct. In the first quarter of 2009, so that's when we took office back then, we'd lost 2.1 million jobs, which averages 700,000 per month for 3 months, something like that. And that was just cataclysmic. I'd never seen anything like it. I hope I never see anything like it again. But the political system actually did respond quickly. Like I said, the Recovery Act was in place less than 4 weeks after the president took office. And remember, this president was never exactly welcomed by the Congress. And I would argue that the stimulus did have a positive impact, but that was a pretty tough argument to make because at the same time that we were implementing this plan, there were the unemployment rate was rising and job growth was negative. So it's sort of hard to get people to feel good about what you're doing when they're really getting hit by the downturn.
Right, and I think it's something that President Obama and the whole team has not gotten enough credit for. I know a lot of people are disappointed in different things that have and haven't happened, but I think he and the whole team, including you, deserve a lot of credit for coming in to office in the middle of a crisis and taking dramatic, bold action that really turned it around to take the economy out of a tailspin. So thank you for that public service.
Well, you're welcome. There's recently a paper that we published here at the Center on Budget by a couple of economists, Alan Blinder and Mark Zandi, and it's called something like Lessons from the Great Recession. You can get it on our website here at the Center on Budget, and it takes you through everything that we did back then and scores how it worked out, looks at the number of jobs, literally millions of jobs created. The unemployment rate was held down a few points, and there will always be an ongoing argument about this sort of thing because people often just have a knee-jerk opposition to government interventions. But it is very well established that when the private sector economy collapses like that, the public sector needs to step in and pick up the slack temporarily.
Right, and you did a phenomenal job there. But as we see now, the policies that were pursued then did rescue the country from that economic crisis, restored economic growth, but that growth has not been widely shared. And since leaving the White House, you've focused on how the fruits of the economy could be more widely shared, and in fact, that's the focus of your latest book, The Reconnection Agenda, Reuniting Growth and Prosperity. Tell us how you came to write that book.
Well, it was an interesting process because I'd written many books in the past, and I would say that for the most part, these books were diagnosis, not prescription. I would spend a lot of time, and economists tend to do this, with graphs and explanations and statistical analysis explaining what happened, and then essentially say, and somebody ought to do something about it, without really thinking through the policy agenda, in this case a reconnection agenda, that was warranted. And so for this book, I just decided to spend very little time diagnosing the problem because I think it's widely agreed upon what's going on. I did have a chapter on that, but I relegated most of the evidence to an appendix saying, if you want to go see the evidence, it's there, go check it out. But every chapter in this book is going to be devoted to a policy solution to reconnecting growth and middle-class prosperity.
I'm so happy you did that, and it's actually one of the major themes on this radio show is a focus on solutions, because if we hear too much about so many of the problems, it can be very depressing, and yet there are lots of good solutions out there, and I thought you did some really good groundbreaking work in this book about solutions on shared prosperity. You mentioned at the top about one of the most important things we could do for really reconnecting middle-class prosperity with the overall growth is by having full employment. So tell us what you mean by full employment and why is it so important?
So full employment is actually very simple to describe. It means a situation where the vast majority of people who are looking for work can not only find jobs, but can find jobs that provide them the number of hours they want to work. One of the problems we've had recently is that there's over 6 million people, which is, by the way, down from, I think, 10 or 11 million, who are working part-time, but they want to work full-time. So in a full employment economy, the matchup between jobs and job seekers is very tight. It corresponds to an unemployment rate that's probably somewhere in the 4% range, but nobody's really sure. That's kind of a technical question, but that's pretty much what full employment is.
Yeah, and I remember living in Massachusetts when Governor Dukakis was in charge, and we got the unemployment rate in the state down to 5%. And it seemed to be at a point where basically anybody who wanted to work would be able to get a job. And it was great because it put some upward pressure on the wages, so the employers were having to offer higher wages to draw workers in. And the wages got high enough, you actually started drawing in people who might not have been in the labor market, but it just it tempted them to actually get in. And it was a happy place for it was a happy place to be, a very lively economy, and anybody who wanted to work pretty much could have a job.
Well, when you're at full employment, employers are facing a much more competitive labor market, and they therefore have to bid up their wage offers to get and keep the workers they need. If they don't do that, if they're feeling particularly cheap and they don't want to share some of their productivity growth with their workforce, they're not going to be able to achieve the kinds of profits that are available to them. So they're essentially leaving money on the table. That's why in full employment economies, you have a much more kind of balanced bargaining power. It's not just that employers can set the conditions. It's that they have to negotiate with workers in a way that they don't when the unemployment rate is high.
Yeah, so it sounds like a good place to be. How do we get to full employment nationally?
You take a left at the airport. No, just the path to full employment is it goes through a couple of different places. First of all, I talk about fiscal policy and monetary policy. So monetary policy is germane because that's the Federal Reserve. We hear a lot about them. The Federal Reserve worries a lot about two things, whether the economy is at full employment or whether the economy is generating too much inflation. And historically, those two different variables have been in opposition to each other. If the economy runs, quote, too hot and unemployment gets too low, they worry that inflation will be too fast. And I think people can imagine that if workers have more bargaining power, and you could imagine them pressing for wage gains, and that could bleed through to prices and so on. So that's kind of the old story. I mean, actually, the real world's a lot more complicated than that. But the Federal Reserve plays a role, and in terms of getting to full employment, it's very important for them to not tap the brakes, not raise interest rates to slow the economy down when we're not yet solidly at full employment. Fiscal policy means the kind right now would mean making the kinds of investments, say, in infrastructure that would create more employment activity for people who are having trouble getting into the job market. It might mean going into some neighborhoods that are very much job deserts. I talked about the incarceration problem before. We know that there are neighborhoods in our country where even in good times people can't get anything like enough employment. So that would be part of fiscal policy. I would say it would be part of the safety net. For example, benefits like the earned income credit, wage subsidies to help increase the income of low-income workers. Those are on the fiscal policy side. And then there's a set of other ideas that are a bit more nuanced, things like direct job creation for people who can't find work. But those are just off the top, a couple of ways to get to full employment. Oh, one other thing. I mentioned the trade deficit before. It's very hard to achieve full employment when you're importing so much more than you're exporting. So that's another chapter in the book.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve here. And you mentioned that it's important that the Federal Reserve not raise the interest rates until we have full employment. And yet here we are recently, the Federal Reserve did raise for the first time in something like 6 years, the Federal Reserve did raise the federal funds interest rate. Do you think they made a mistake in doing that too soon, or do you think they were doing the right thing to kind of restore normalization to the interest rates?
I think they made a little mistake by acting too soon. I should carefully articulate what I mean by that. When I say they shouldn't raise rates until we're at full employment, really what I have in the back of my mind is they shouldn't raise rates until they really see that there's an inflationary problem. That is, the Fed, I tend to focus on the absence of full employment because it's been such a big problem for working people, and it's been such a driver of this inequality in all the ways we've been talking about. But they have a perfectly reasonable mandate to worry about inflation as well. The problem is that we just haven't had much by way of inflation for many, many years now. Now, that may sound wrong to people who are out there shopping, and I respect that. I know where you're coming from. But from the Fed's perspective, from the kind of measures they look at, we just don't really see much at all in the way of faster inflation. Actually, to the contrary, I've seen deflationary evidence, that is slower price growth, especially around collapsing oil prices. So I didn't see any reason for the Fed to raise. However, they only raised a quarter of a point, so that's not much of a mistake.
Yeah, and they, I think it was yesterday or earlier this week, said they're not going to raise it again, or didn't raise it again at this point. So I think if we can just kind of hold steady there and wait until there's more, like you said, why take steps to reduce inflation until we have inflation as a problem, which we don't yet.
You know, they're tapping the brakes when the car isn't even moving all that quickly yet. So I don't see it, but they haven't done much. You know, I wouldn't say they've really done much damage, but it is a move in the wrong direction.
I really like your focus with employment as central to what we need to do here, and as really the best solution to poverty is a job. And you know, you are very good not only about making sure that anyone in the middle class who wants a job can be working, but also addressing the issue of the long-term unemployed. And we're all concerned as Americans about the riots in Baltimore just about a year ago, and just kind of the question of what do we do about the long-term unemployed? You know, people with little education, people who face discrimination, maybe displaced factory workers who are having a hard time getting back into the workforce now that their factory is shut down. So what do you think we can do about the long-term unemployed?
Well, I think they are a somewhat disparate group, so there's not one solution. If you think about the kind of demographics I was talking about a few minutes ago, so you mentioned Sandpoint, Baltimore. In fact, recent economic analysis has found that there are, you know, maybe, I don't know, 50 neighborhoods in the United States, that's just off the top of my head, where it's just not only really hard for people to make ends meet in ways that provide them and their kids with what they need, but actually are doing significant damage to the lifetime economic mobility and chances of their children. And so in cases like that, I consider it somewhat of an emergency, and I would argue that there are that to the extent that families can relocate in places where there's a more robust economy, more opportunity, that's one solution, but that's not going to work for everyone. So I would argue that there's a good area for direct job creation. That is, people need probably some training and some education to make sure that they're job ready, and then we would create employment for folks to work either in the private sector or the public sector. It could be a matter of infrastructure. I've got an idea called FAST, Fix America Schools Today. We've got 100,000 public schools across the country. Many of them are seriously in need of repair. What about a deep dive into that sort of thing, where we train people and directly create jobs for them to help improve the energy efficiency and the attractiveness and the insulation, replace windows, replace boilers, replace roofs in our public education stock? Now, that would be a significant investment, but as I mentioned earlier, borrowing costs are low, and this is precisely the kind of infrastructure that we need. So one answer is help train people in order to move into jobs that we create for them to do stuff we need.
Yeah, I think that's great, and there's certainly plenty of work we need to do to repair our aging infrastructure. We get, you know, bridges falling down in Minnesota and all over the place. You know, we need a lot of help with the roads and bridges. That's a lot of jobs.
What about the water? What about the water in Flint?
Water in Flint. Yes, let's start by providing clean water to our families.
I mean, that's part of the infrastructure as well.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about full employment as a way, you know, just having full employment would increase the bargaining power for middle and low-income workers. But, you know, used to be that's what unions would do. And now with the decline of the unions, it seems to me that's one of the biggest reasons we don't have as much shared prosperity as we used to have. So now we're needing to turn to government policy to, in a way, pick up some of the slack with the decline of the unions. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I definitely talk about not just the decline of unions as one factor behind, not broadly speaking, the increase in inequality, but more specifically, the loss of bargaining power. I mean, in fact, we call union organizing collective bargaining. And so that's absolutely a factor. And I talk about some very bad ideas going on at the state level, this notion of what's called right to work. It's really right to work for less, I think, is the way I talk about it. And these are rules that basically make it really hard for private sector unions to organize at the state level. And we've seen that states that implement these rules that are anti-union tend to have lower pay for working people. By the way, the full employment idea is very much a response to the decline in unions. The idea is that if we don't, if people aren't able to manifest much in the way of collective bargaining or bargaining power through unions, then the tight labor market becomes their only friend in that regard.
Right, exactly. You know, it's interesting. We've had a pretty long period here with an expansion of the private sector adding millions of jobs. And I'm kind of wondering, why hasn't that put more pressure on paying higher wages at this point?
Well, it's a very good question, and it only now looks like it may be starting to do that. So for a good long while, the rate of at which pay was growing was about 2%, and that's before inflation, so about 2% if you look at annual pay growth. Most recently, it's clocked up to around 2.5%, and I do think the reason for that is the diminished slack in the labor market, and I think the answer to your question as to why we didn't see that early is because we had a lot more slack than people thought. The unemployment rate, for a variety of technical reasons, was actually biased down. So when the unemployment rate was 6% or 5.5% or even 5%, people thought, boy, it's really low unemployment. But for a number of reasons, it wasn't really that low at all. One of the problems is that a lot of people left the labor market because there wasn't enough opportunity for them. And when you leave the labor market, you're not counted among the jobless anymore. So that put a downward bias on that unemployment rate.
Right. So there's a lot more people who are unemployed than the unemployment rate is going to show based on people who have given up looking or taken themselves out of the labor market for whatever reason. And it seems to me there's also another factor here on why there hasn't been more pressure to pay higher wages given the expansion of jobs in the private sector, and that is that we've had job losses in the public sector that I think we've had net job losses in the government at all three levels, local, state, and federal. And that having those people out there now, they'll be competing, looking for jobs with the other folks, too. So that's kind of unusual, isn't it, to have that big net job losses in government?
Well, I mean, one of the problems that we had during the recession was that especially state and local governments really contracted. Interestingly, the federal government, as everybody knows, I think, can run a budget deficit. They can spend more than they take in a given year, but states can't do that. They have to balance their budgets. And one of the ways they did that was by laying people off. And you're right, that pushed the other way, both in terms of extending the length and depth of the downturn, but also, sure, once people leave the public sector, they're competing for employment in the rest of the economy.
Yeah, you know, I think it's so remarkable to have President Obama criticized for being such a, you know, people calling him a socialist, pro-government, all that, all the rest of it. But actually, it was under Obama's administration that we've actually had government job losses and cut back, which under President Reagan, who talked a lot about making government smaller and shrinking it down, actually the government still grew under President Reagan. It's just kind of ironic.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing, that's true. The other thing that happened under President Obama's watch is that while middle incomes have been taking a long time to recover, the stock market, you know, more than doubled since early 2010. So if you look at President Obama's record, he's about the lousiest socialist I can imagine. I think he's done a lot of great stuff, don't get me wrong, and he's also been blocked every step of the way. But the kinds of complaints you're talking about are not fact-based. That's just people you know, blowing smoke, as it were.
Right, I think that's true, but it's interesting. I think it's kind of a blowback now on the Republicans who were calling President Obama a socialist, because people are looking at it going, well, we got the stock market's improved, the jobs are, instead of losing and hemorrhaging jobs, we're adding millions of jobs. So if he's a socialist, maybe it's not such a bad thing. And I think they've defanged the term to the point now when they're hoping to use it against Bernie Sanders, who is a Democratic socialist. And there's that recent poll in Iowa showing that 43% of the primary or the caucus goers in Iowa consider themselves socialists.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Another one of your solutions has, in order to bring about shared prosperity, has to do with interventions that prevent financial institutions from taking huge risks that then put the taxpayers on the hook for bailing them out. Tell us what you think needs to be done in terms of reining in these financial institutions or setting some kind of a framework so that they can't take risks that then we have to pay for.
Well, there are four ideas that I tout in the book, and I know that this stuff can get pretty arcane, but let me try to briefly summarize them. One is called large capital buffers. The other is something called a strong Volcker rule. The third is a strong and active Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the fourth gets back to the Federal Reserve, a Federal Reserve that does much more vigilant oversight around this issue of what's called systemic risk and particularly bubbles. Now, in terms of capital buffers, one of the ways that banks, and not just the kind of banks on the corner that you go to do your everyday banking, but investment banks that make deals for investors, that one of the ways they make profits is they borrow. They try to borrow at low rates and essentially lend at high rates. And this kind of arbitrage is a very effective way of making a lot of money, especially if you can borrow at low rates, as has been the case over the last few decades. Well, the problem occurs when all your deals go bad and you've borrowed, you've leveraged up, and the loans that you have outstanding are you can't pay them back. Basically, you're insolvent. And the way to avoid that is essentially disallowing excessive leveraging, excessive borrowing. And that's what we mean by large capital buffers. It means that the bank has to have a layer of equity or capital such that if they experience a number of bad loans that they have to charge off or write off, they have room to do that without threatening insolvency. So that's part part one. Part two is this Volcker Rule idea, which is just a way of preventing institutions that have a taxpayer backing—that is, that their accounts are insured by the federal government, just like FDIC. We all benefit from that. We can't let those institutions put their commercial side at risk, and so we have to disallow this kind of really risky activity among banks that have FDIC backing. The third thing was the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and that's the idea of trying to avoid people getting in over their heads with unsustainable borrowing through better oversight in the consumer borrowing market. And the final idea was making sure that the Federal Reserve is looking out for bubbles. They're not nearly as hard to spot as Alan Greenspan or even Ben Bernanke said beforehand, and to her credit, Janet Yellen has said, you know, we really can't afford to be that cavalier about bubbles. We're going to have to try to make sure that we do a better job of seeing them coming and not letting them inflate.
Yeah, I think those all sound sensible, and, you know, it does, you know, part of what I like about it is you're saying if they want to take big risks, the financial institutions can do so, but that they shouldn't be allowed to take big financial risks in a way that makes the taxpayers have to pay for their mistakes, which is kind of right. What happened in 2008. So, you know, we got Senator Bernie Sanders here saying we should break up the big banks. Do you agree with that as one of the measures we should take?
That doesn't strike me as where I would go. I mean, I think, and the reason is not because I have any particularly warm feelings towards the big banks. It's that I'm just as nervous about small banks as I am big banks. I don't think it's really size that brings you down. I think it's connectivity. It's the interconnectedness. You know, Lehman Brothers wasn't the biggest bank on Wall Street by a long shot, but it had so many interconnections such that when it failed, it started a domino effect that led to failures not just across the economy but across the globe. So I actually think more germane than size is for banking for like the Federal Reserve. I talked about the important role of the Federal Reserve in providing better financial oversight, particularly vis-a-vis bubbles inflating. Well, they actually have a relatively new function, the FSOC, the Financial Stability Oversight Committee, FSOC, that's designed to look out for what precisely I'm talking about, a level of interconnectivity that risky such that if one link in the chain goes bad, the thing can fall apart. And so that's more basically what I'm talking about. What I would say more so than breaking up the big banks is the kind, if we have those four rules in place that I mentioned, that I don't think the kind of interconnectivity that hurt us last time can mess us up again. Probably the most important thing there, by the way, is those capital buffers. Basically, if you can take a hit to your holdings such that your enough of your loans are non-performing, and yet absorb that hit with reducing, you know, your equity share, basically have enough of a capital buffer between your bad loans and your insolvency, I think that would be a great line of defense.
Yeah, no, capital buffers, by that do you mean something like right now if you're a big financial institution, is say you've got $1 million in the bank available, you can actually, you know, make trades and purchases and investments. Isn't it 10 to 1 or something that you could, if you had $1 million, you could actually invest in up to $10 million based on the $1 million that you actually had?
Exactly. But, so that if you invest $10 million and, you know, 500,000 goes bad, you have a million that can absorb that. If a million goes bad, you've just burned through your buffer, and if 2 million goes bad, you're insolvent. So that's precisely what I'm talking about. And, you know, ratios of 10 to 1 are actually, not bad. I mean, during the housing bubble and bust, those ratios got up to, 50 and 60 to 1.
Yeah, so we definitely want to limit that so the financial institutions don't get over-leveraged and they're very precarious, particularly when they're making high-risk investments. Sounds sensible to me. What do you think about a speculation tax?
Well, I think that I'm probably more interested in something called a financial transaction tax, which is I think maybe the same thing.
Yes.
I think they may be just different words for the same thing. And that I think is a smart idea. This is the idea that for every financial transaction, that is, you trade a share of stock, you trade a security, you buy a bond, there is a tiny little tax on the transaction that amounts to something like 0.01%, maybe 2, maybe 3 if you want to go big. Actually, Bernie goes to 0.5% on stocks, which I think is too high, but perhaps he's just in the negotiating phase, you know, start high and come down.
Right.
But okay. The idea, though, is that a tax like that would be small enough not to, I think, distort trading or liquidity in financial markets, generate significant revenue, and importantly, we haven't talked about this, but a very small financial transaction tax, even something like 0.01%, would be enough to dampen some of this high-speed noise trading that is very much algorithmic or computer-driven, that really doesn't add anything useful to the economy, but finds these, you know, tiny nanosecond arbitrage opportunities and makes a lot of money through, again, this kind of high-speed trading co-location, meaning that you put your server really close to the stock market exchange, so you're getting information before other people. I think a tiny financial transaction tax would make a lot of that stuff go away, and that I think a lot of people, and including many traders, would judge that to be a useful thing.
Well, that would be great, and maybe that's part of how we can finance this direct job creation to help repair the infrastructure and get us clean water and all that good stuff.
Right. I mean, that's kind of a very important implicit point that I'm glad you made explicit, which is that if we're going to do the kinds of things that I have in the Reconnection Agenda, which, by the way, when you tote them all up, they're not all that expensive. I mean, things like full employment in many ways generate more growth themselves. I mean, the only time we've really balanced our budgets in recent years is when we've had full employment economies that spin off a lot of revenues. But yes, I think the idea is that we're going to need more robust revenue collection if we're going to not just push back against inequality and our weakening infrastructure, but simply meet the obligations we have, so vis-a-vis Social Security, Medicare, things like that.
Yeah. And do you think the measures we've put in place since 2008, and I'm thinking now particularly of Dodd-Frank, but you know, other measures that have been taken, do you think we've prevented another collapse like that again, or has there not really been significant enough change that we're vulnerable to another 2008 kind of economic crisis?
Well, we're definitely always vulnerable. I mean, there's no. I can't think of any policy intervention that would make you say, "Well, it's now completely safe, and that financial markets aren't going to go off the rails again." And in fact, there's a really important economist whose work is, I think, finally getting the recognition it deserves, a guy who died maybe 20 years ago, something like that, named Hyman Minsky. And Hyman Minsky argued that the way the cycle works is that you have a crash like we had, and everybody gets all wound up and says, we have to have a new regulatory regime to keep this from happening the last time, and they scurry around and come up with a Dodd-Frank or something, and then things start taking off again, and everybody's happy, and everyone forgets about the last implosion, and you're off to the races. Next thing you know, you're back where you started. So there is this cycle wherein simply time leads you to forget the corrective measures that you put in place. We've got to be smarter than that, and I do think that Dodd-Frank actually accomplishes a number of those. Really, every one of those four ideas I mentioned earlier are at to some degree or other embedded in Dodd-Frank. But the issue that Minsky recognizes that doesn't really help you if you forget about them. So it's all a matter of staying awake at the switch.
Right, exactly. And I also wanted to ask you about women in the economy. Do you agree that there is a gender wage gap at every level of the labor force? And what do you think we can do about increasing women's economic security?
I've lost you.
Well, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi there. So we're just talking about the women in the economy and how do we close the gender wage gap. We're talking with Jared Bernstein on All Together Now on Progressive Radio Network. Jared Bernstein has a number of exciting ideas, and his book is well worth reading, and I highly recommend it to you. If you go to jaredbernsteinblog.com, you will find it for free. You can download it and take a look at it, and I recommend that you do that. And just to recap some of what we've been talking about, Jared Bernstein's been an advisor at the highest levels of government, advisor to President Obama and to Vice President Biden, and wrote a book on connecting our economic growth with shared prosperity. So he was also the director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class and is very focused on how to strengthen the middle class. Some of the proposals he's suggesting are first and foremost to move towards a full employment economy, and that means getting people more jobs. We're actually doing better. You know, in the crisis of 2008, unemployment was soaring above 10% and much higher in certain sectors, particularly among young people and young adults. But unemployment is now down from 10% to about 5%. Yet in spite of the increased economic growth, many Americans are still struggling financially. Wages are flat and real income of a typical household still has not recovered what was lost in the 2008 downturn. So there's a number of factors that Jared Bernstein pointed to as to why that's so and why growth is not being more widely shared. So for solutions on what we need to do for increased shared prosperity, is Mr. Bernstein still on the line? Some of the solutions that Jared Bernstein was offering were that we should bring about full employment and make sure that anybody who wants a job has a job. And his suggestion on the two biggest tools we can use to achieve full employment are the fiscal policies and the monetary policies. And basically, fiscal policies around taxing and spending. What do we tax and how much? And spending, which he recommends using to create direct job creation, so that the government would hire people to do infrastructure repair, rebuild our roads and bridges, provide clean water, which they could maybe start with Flint, Michigan, and the families there who have been drinking polluted water for a couple of years now. And in terms of the monetary policy, we know of the Federal Reserve, and they basically set the federal funds interest rate. And his recommendation is do not raise the interest rate until we have full employment. The Federal Reserve says they're concerned about inflation, but inflation is not a problem. And until it is a problem, we should keep the interest rates low. So we know the best solution to poverty is a job. And we know that there are many people in the middle and lower class, particularly, who want a job but can't find work. Maybe someone displaced from a factory, someone with either little education or not very good education, in some cases people who are discriminated against. There's millions of people there, and the best would be if everybody who can work does work, and that the government has a role to play in making sure that folks have jobs that they can work at. And Mr. Bernstein was talking about having a financial transaction tax, which could generate some funds. It could actually generate hundreds of millions of dollars, just a very small, maybe 0.01%. Bernie Sanders is saying 0.5%. When someone is buying a stock or a bond, doing some kind of transaction, a very small fee on that. But first of all, it might not really be noticed because it's so small, but there are so many millions of these transactions all the time that that could generate serious funds in order to pay for rebuilding our roads and bridges and putting people to work. So I hope to have Mr. Bernstein on again some other time, and we can continue to ask him about his important information on what we can do to make sure that more people share in the prosperity that's out there, and that it, not all the wealth should be going to the top 1%, but to have it more broadly shared so we have a stronger middle class in the United States. So that's all the time we have. I appreciate Jared Bernstein being with us today and the great work that he's done. And that's it for our show today. In case you've missed any of the other programs, they are in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now. Now that we know.